Cyclocross friends, and thanks for tuning in to episode 181 of Cyclocross Radio. On today's show, it's Tim Johnson. It's been a while since we chatted with Tim Johnson, and it's always good to catch up. You know Tim, cyclocross icon, and most recently, the USA Cycling Foundation Development Director. That sounds very grown up. My goal in speaking with Tim was really just to chat, just to catch up, to tell some cool stories. I didn't want to get into cancellations and postponements and effects of the virus and social distancing and who did what right and who did what wrong. We've been through a lot of that. We're going to go through a lot of it more. I think all of us need a little bit of a diversion as well. We're not taking any of those issues less seriously, but I think it's good also to have something that's away from that. So that's really what we're getting at in this episode. We're brought to you by Works Tools, as always, and they started with the Hydro Shot with us over the Wide Angle Podium Network. We moved on to a whole slew of tools. I think you're really going to like this company. Go check them out, especially when you're stuck at home. You're going to be doing these home projects. Works can help you get all of those done. Go to yourcleanbike.com. Check out everything that's there. Load up your shopping basket. Check out and then use the code GEARUP, G-E-A-R-U-P, GEARUP at yourcleanbike.com. You'll get 15% off of Works Tools. Also, go to whoop.com. I know you're at home, but that doesn't mean you have to stop working out. You can go out for those solo rides. You can go out for a run. You can do your aerobics with the cats and the dogs in the living room. All of it counts. All of it's going to be monitored by Whoop. You're going to know how much sleep you're getting. You're going to know how much strain you have, how much rest you need. It's a great system for tracking all of those metrics that we want to know about, because once this quarantine's lifted, once we are through this and we're out there and competing again, you're going to be ready to roll with the Whoop band. Whoop.com. Use the code WAP and you're going to get 15% off of either a 12 or 18 month subscription. Finally, go to wideanglepodium.com. Go check out all the stuff we have there. I'm not even going to tell you the whole spiel about being a member. I don't care at this point. You know, we'll get back to that once we're all ready to think about that. But right now, I just want you to have all of the content that you could want during this downtime. And it's available at wideanglepodium.com. Go load up on all those podcasts. All right. We got Tim Johnson. He's on the phone. We're chatting with him. He's telling stories. He's drinking beer. And we're doing that right now. Okay, I'm recording now. I wish I would have recorded like 10 seconds before so I could have gotten the beautiful sound of you opening that beer. But
if this podcast goes well, we can always open another one.
Okay.
I'll only have 11 sips of sunshine.
Yeah,
left,
I don't know if I want you to do that. I feel that this is...
I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
That's for sure. If there's ever a reason for me not to do that, it's this.
We talk about, you know, you look back at all the, from rationing during world wars to gas rationing during the 70s. I don't want you to get to a point where, you know, you're in a dire straits from beer rationing.
Do you know that the whole Shackleton thing involved my ability to ration food? So it wasn't just my ability to handle cold. You know, if I have something that tastes good or is really valuable to me, I will definitely ration it out even in normal times. But now I've turned up the prepper dial, and I've you know, been working on how I'm stocking the pantry and the fridges and all of the other things that are kind of going along these days.
Well, that's probably I mean, not to get too serious about it, but probably a good thing, because we don't know where we're going as far as supply chains and all of that kind of stuff. But one of the reasons that I wanted to chat with you, and you even asked me the same question, because I think when people see your name on here, they're going to be like, oh, Tim Johnson, USA Cycling Foundation. This is going to be, you know, we're going to be like talking about what's going on today and cycling being canceled for now, racing at least, and all this kind of stuff. And I said, no. I really don't want to talk about that. And I think that there are plenty of other outlets, even on the wide angle podium, where we're going to be talking about that a lot. And I think there are serious conversations to be had. But Tim, I was like, I just want to talk to my buddy Tim about about war stories and cyclocross and even road cycling if it's out there. And
even road cycling. Yeah. How about mountain biking? Can we talk about mountain biking too?
Yeah. What's your history with mountain bike racing?
Well, that's where I started, remember?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, mountain biking is definitely something that I dream of on days like this when I am not going outside as much as I would be going. I'm thinking back to when I started and why I started. Yeah, mountain biking always comes up. And even in the future, I mean, going to BC Bike Race in July was always on the calendar. And as the goalposts move, Tom Brady joke here, we can make decisions as they come. But yeah, I love mountain biking.
Yeah, I think the Tom Brady joke would be me asking you if you feel deflated.
The masshole response would be, who the fuck is Tom Brady?
Right.
That was a short-lived time here in Boston.
Yeah, anybody can win 6 rings.
Yeah, no big deal. It's only 20 years. Yeah. I appreciate the ability to kind of expand a little bit. But, you know, actually, one thing that I will say is that I have been really thankful for what USAC has been doing around how people are getting to be aware of this. So when we talk about a topic, an awareness that goes across the world in different speeds and reaches people at different times, the cycling community is really pretty up to date, you know, as far as following social media or being engaged in this virtual world beyond their own horizon. Cyclists definitely pick things up quicker, you know, whether it's a geopolitical issue, now that it's a global pandemic issue. I feel like cyclists have been kind of seeing this coming more than other groups out there. And so it has been really good. Like, we had a webinar with Dr. Michael Rashan, who's an ER doc. He's the chief medical staff of Penrose Hospital Group in Colorado Springs. And he just happens to have a PhD in immunology. And so he is like, you know, the number one guy to talk about this. But the way that it came about was that he had signed up for a foundation trip to go to Strada Bianchi at the beginning of March. And I was leading the trip. We had, a dozen people total. And we were going over there. And as this thing starts coming in January into February, it's like, hey, doc, what's going on? What do you think? And we were able to make a decision to cancel it in time, thank God. Like, the Monday return, we would have been, the Monday flight home would have been just after Strada Bianchi. That was the day that they shut down the entire country. So we saved a lot of pain and agony for a lot of people. But having him to be a resource, he's done 2 webinars now. You can find him on usacycling.org in the safe sport and well-being section of the website. You go back and watch him. You know, they're really clear, precise looks at what this means for us, you know, from a cycling perspective, whether you're riding or you're watching, you kind of understand why they're canceling events now. Like, we get bummed out about that, but you know, there are reasons behind it, and it's been really good. So that was my pitch.
Yeah. No, I think I actually want to go back and watch that webinar.
Said no one ever, but
were you mountain biking in the, was this like Norba era?
Yeah. So I started in 91 going into 92. So heyday.
Yeah.
It was, junior, beginner, mountain bike race in Lynnwoods, Massachusetts. Turned sport after three races because I won a race and I was like, yeah, I'm going to be sport. And then, yeah, I started going to nationals at the end of that year. We had the world championships in Bromont, Quebec, which was a whole nother country at that time, totally out of, you know, out of the realm of possibility I would ever go there for any reason. And yeah, they were awesome. I was just talking about it the other day with Mark Gullickson. I was trying to figure out when Gully started mountain biking.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a video that went around about the Helen, Georgia National in 1994. And it was him and Tomac and Ned. They were battling for, you know, the national title. It was like the full production show. It was big broadcast cameras, like, parked next to a stream crossing in the middle of the woods in like sweaty Georgia woods. God, it was awesome. Really cool to think back to that.
Yeah, that's always my the thing that I bring up when people talk about cyclocross, especially in the last couple of years, and we're sort of seeing that plateau now a little bit. Maybe hopefully we'll get that bump back, but and people are like, oh, this is just going to keep growing and growing and growing. And I'm always like, go talk to a mountain biker from the 90s. You know, there's a cautionary tale there with Norba, and because the scene was enormous, wasn't it? I mean, it was like the biggest thing going.
We had 1,000 people at a local race in Rhode Island. Cautionary tale, huh? That was something we brought up a lot when we were in Bentonville for the Gravel America Summit. Was just that, yes, these are days of plenty, you know, for everyone. But it's not like it's going to be like that forever. You can't be on the run up the entire time. But while it's here, let's figure out why we're here and what made us, what allowed us to get here, what allows people to find gravel to be the thing that they want to do all the time and explore and you know, go to events and be a part of something new. And it was awesome. I loved being with those guys, the whole crew. It was awesome.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely seems like there's a lot of enthusiasm there and a lot of creativity, and it's interesting you brought that up because people always talk about like gravel now being the new cyclocross, but it does seem to have that same feel to where we were 15-20 years ago in cyclocross when we were all kind of figuring it out, basically scaling it up to where we are today.
Yeah, and scale is good. The thing that I never want to have happen with gravel is to where the door shuts. And I think cross had a much more open entrance for a lot of people for a long time. And then it became, you had to have the right bike. You had to have enough of the right bikes, enough of the right tires, like all the things that allowed us to really geek out on it kind of ended up being somewhat of a detriment to people just getting into it. Because if you didn't know all the different ways the cross was crossed, like it was hard to drop in and out when it was easier back then. You know, people would be a roadie and do two or three cross races a year. They would still be a bike rider, you know, still be a cyclist, but they weren't going to 10 cross races a year, which I think was the thing that forced a lot of people to kind of choose. And I don't want gravel to ever have to choose. Like it should be as easy and open for everyone as it possibly can be.
You're talking to the guy who on Twitter floated the idea of amateur racers only allowed to bring one bike to a cyclocross event. And then, oh boy, let me tell you what my mentions looked like.
Wait, you said something on Twitter? I didn't know that.
Yeah, no, every once in a while I like to poke in, see what's happening. Wow.
Do you want to compare Twitter drafts folders someday? Because God.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
I think I think you are better at being vigilant on not sending them out than I am.
Oh God. I'm trying to figure out if it's choking me or if it's allowing me to express myself to a very small audience, i.e. me, like when I actually go back and look at my drafts folder.
I think that's a lot of it. A lot of times I end up mistakenly sending out stuff and then quickly deleting it. And that's kind of the game that I play, because I realize that, because my whole thing in this, I don't know if this is, this should just be common sense, but I think it also comes in from just, you know, law school and practicing and everything, is that you have to think three steps ahead about what the outcome is going to be from your either, you know, saying something, making a motion, asking a question, whatever else. You know, you have to know, you have to look at, it may feel good just to say it, but that's there's beyond that. You have to understand what the response is going to be for it. And in the end, is that really beneficial to anybody? And even from your point of view, when they respond, are you going to feel better? Usually if it's something adversarial, no, you're not.
That's a very calculated way of looking at it. You know, it's funny. Maybe the next time we talk, we should go back and we pick a random number between 1 and like 2,500. And that'll be the days backwards. And we each read a tweet that we wrote and try and figure out what the reason was that we wrote it in the first place. And what the outcome was.
Yeah, that'll be good. I don't have to ever worry about running for office, but man, could you just imagine what would come back?
Yeah, no, you would have a very small constituency that people knew that you cared about.
Yeah, yeah.
And they'd be like, good for you.
So give me a memory from those Norba days. Give me that one. Give me that story.
Well, I can tell you where the John Swa came from.
Oh yes, perfect.
It's not really a Norba, but yeah, that was like 1993 at the Mont Saint Anne World Cup. We all drove up from New England. That was the closest World Cup we could go see. Who was big then? We could go see Missy Giovi. We could see Lopes. We could see Tomac and Ned. I don't know if Rune Hoydahl was big yet. He was big a little later. Floyd was up there back then. He was still a junior. And so we had this crew that we all started racing together. We would always camp, and they had a VW bus, and I would sleep on the floor or outside in a tent with my two buddies, John and Andrew Mahoney. And, Paul Boudreau was there, Fat Sean. We were all camping just down the street from Mont Saint Anne, across from the McDonald's, which was awesome. Really helpful for us, because that's where we ate every day. We were racing slalom, downhill, and cross country. And in the downhill race, I go down and I'm flying through the woods. I'm having a great race and I flat. And so I end up, I think I broke my wheel too, but I had to walk a lot of the descent. And then eventually I come across the line. And so the announcer is sitting there. He's trying to do bilingual for most everyone. And I come across the line and he says my name as Tim Jean-Swa, 2447. It took me 24 minutes to get down this stupid mountain. And all my friends were waiting there because we were all racing at the same time. You know, they would send you down basically like mega avalanche style when you were an amateur downhiller in the 90s. And everyone would just wait, covered in mud, waiting for the rest of your buddies to come down. And there I am, limping my way across the line. And he says, Tim Jean-Swa, 2447. And that's how I became Jean-Swa. And they just called me that relentlessly after that.
I had no idea it was a take on your actual last name. That is that, man, I learned something very, very good here in this conversation. That's good.
Yep. Yeah, no, that was the same trip. We had a buddy who we met at Mount Snow, who I think he was from New Jersey, maybe, but he was friends with somebody else in New Hampshire, and we knew each other. We camped next to each other, and you know, evenings in a campground at a mountain bike race like that, it's like everyone's doing their thing. They're racing all day long. And then everyone kind of comes back to eat or to hang out. We weren't even drinking beers. I mean, God, I was 15 then. And this kid rolls up and he has Missy Giovi's dual slalom bike with the number plate on it. Brand new. And we knew him, but we didn't know him that well. It wasn't like he stole the bike, we thought. But like, what the fuck is this kid who's maybe 15? He wasn't my age. He might have been 14. What is he doing with Missy Giovi's factory dual slalom bike, who is like the hottest thing in mountain biking at the time? And he just rides to our campsite. We're not that close to the venue. Like, this is probably 4 miles from the venue downhill. So he took the bike from the truck, rode it downhill to our place, and then was going to ride back. And so we're all looking at this thing, and it's like having Ayrton Senna drive up in an F1 car in the middle of like a Cars and Coffee scene on a Sunday morning. And we're like, what the hell is going on? How did you get this? And he's like, well, you know, I met her at Mount Snow and she was really nice. And so I was talking to her and I said I needed to get home. So she lent me her bike. And so there's this kid who, at the generosity of Missy Giovi, takes the bike, rides it all the way back to the campground to have it all night long, and then ride it back in the morning as his transportation. Like, different times, that man. Different times.
Oh, yeah. I can't even imagine. Could you even imagine, like, touching someone's bike these days at a race like that? Much
seriously.
Less.
Oh, my God.
You just hear the stories that of the mechanics that, like, even if they ride it to the to the wash area, like, that's just a no-no. You do not ride the rider's bikes. You know, it's like you gotta walk it or carry it or whatever.
I mean, dude, I got yelled at for riding my own bike. I mean, it's not out of place to yell at someone for touching a bike inside of the rope, you know, the wrong way, looking at it the wrong way. Yeah. You might, those tubulars are really delicate. They've been aged for a long time. Careful.
So speaking of tubulars, all right. So one of the themes that I sort of go off on sometimes is cyclocross, domestic cyclocross today versus domestic cyclocross kind of in the when Tim Johnson was at the peak of his powers.
Yeah, and a long time ago.
Sure. But just the difference this may be on me. Maybe I'm just getting old too, but I look at the competition and I look at everybody and I love all those guys, as I know you do too. And everybody is pretty friendly. And the racing is kind of, that would be my knock on it, is the racing is kind of
too friendly
as well. And I look back at your days and, I may be, you know, out of line here. I would say even on your own team, there seemed to be some tension there at times between your own riders, much less when y'all were ganging up on everybody else out there. Is my perception wrong about just what was going on between the tape at that time versus now?
Man, I know exactly what you're saying. And I don't know why, but I definitely can tell you how it was happening, because it was, when I started, I was on Saturn and I was a young pup with Frank and Mark and Bart Bowen. Bart Bowen is US Pro Champ. Mark was US Pro Champ to be. Frankie was US Pro Champ, should have been, Olympian, should have been. I mean, there was a lot of HP on that.
For those who may not know, these are the McCormack brothers, just legends.
Right. Legends in bike racing in general. Bart Bowen, you know, still involved now, thankfully. But, you know, at the time he was total hotshot. Like, when the Olympic team was made in 2000, those three, along with Antonio Cruz, were our best riders outside of US Postal, for sure. That was a very small list of riders who were actually that good. But so when I joined that team, we had We had learning experiences. I was young and dumb, and I would go as hard as I possibly could for as long as I possibly could. And sometimes that was an hour, and I could win. And then their plan or their tactic then was definitely not the same thing. They would go only as hard as they needed to until they had a chance to put the knife in you and you were going to get second through 10th. Like whatever moment that was, you never knew when it was going to happen. They were able to make it happen. So we just had these really differing tactics going against each other. So it was hard. I mean, Nationals in Kansas City, when I won in 2000 over Gully, that was probably the hardest one day of, oh shit, like, what does this mean for the team? It wasn't even a team. We're all wearing the same jersey, but it wasn't really a team. Like, what does it actually mean? And then, you know, that continued through, God, like Gully and Todd, you know, Todd Wells came on to cross late. Gully was already on the team. Mongoose Hyundai, they built the squad. Like, they were racing together. And then, you know, Todd wins Nationals in Baltimore in 2001. I mean, there are always going to be, you know, inter-team rivalries, but there were intra-team rivalries also. And so by the time Jeremy and I were racing together, he was young and up and coming, and I was established, and I wanted to kill him and he wanted to kill me. And, you know, besides wanting to strangle each other off the bike, it was like, we would hug as much as we would want to strangle each other, you know, and that's just natural, I think.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I was getting at. I mean, that team was so interesting, that, you know, team that still goes on this day, Stu's Cannondale Cyclocross World Team, which just had that vibe. But even then, you know, and this is, you could, but you all, when you were the strongest ones out there, would be at each other's throats. And then, you know, I just specifically remember the times Jonathan Page would come home, and then everything, and then it was just like Cannondale versus Page, you know, and it was just this whole other dynamic where you guys were like, okay, we're on the same, you know, page or here. And that just, I don't know. I just look back at those and I was like, oh man, as somebody outside of the tape watching that, those were just such cool times.
There was a lot to be gained. There was a lot on the line every time. It wasn't just the, you know, $500 prize money. It was like, you know, you knew that you were going to get something from a win. You would get something from a series championship. You would get something from a national championship jersey. And we had a lot of people going for it. I mean, at that time, we had way more spillover from road into cross. We had mountain bike spillover. When Adam Craig shows up and he's actually been riding instead of kayaking, you know, he's not going top five at a World Cup mountain bike race. You know, he was one of the best riders of our generation by far in sheer ability and skill level. When he showed up to a cross race, like, you had to pick your game up or else. And same goes for when Paige would come back. Like, depending on how he was riding, you didn't know what you were going to get, but he was always up for it. And I think that I was always a racer first. I hated to train by myself. I was always like happy to ride with the group, but when it was time to race, I wanted to race and I wanted to fight. And that was, it came out in different ways at different times. Sometimes there are tears and sometimes there are, you know, really deep laughter and appreciation for the person next to you.
Yeah. All right. Looking at that and looking at, and you're right. I think that it was sort of outside factors, and there was, I mean, would you say there was more money there, more opportunity at the time than what we see now? Take that away. Look at what's going on today. I still think that we have a good, I look at this from a business perspective, because I think that's how we succeed, but we have a good product out there with what mm-hmm. we're doing, but it certainly is different. So what's your takeaway from what we're looking at in domestic, which is my main concern at this point, domestic cyclocross versus what we had a generation ago?
I think that we just have a whole lot of unidentified players. We have people that are participating at at almost the highest level pretty consistently, but we haven't really done a good job of pinning who those people are, pinning those people down and who they are, what they're doing, how we can follow along. You know, the media component is always a tough one because, you know, at back in the old days, starting a sentence like that fucking kills me, but back in the old days, we had very limited media outlets. Two, you know, we had Velo News and we might've had Bicycling if they had something. And the internet was nascent and there wasn't a whole lot there. So it was very, very centralized into what mattered or not. When Velo News was the media partner for the USGP, or sorry, for the Super Cup first, it gave us a guaranteed venue for our personalities and results to shine. So now we've got a million different ways of consuming whatever we're doing at any particular time, whether it's a hobby or a sport or a profession or, you know, nothing dominates a Saturday or Sunday. And so we don't really have a retail version of cyclocross. We have a very specific version of it, but it hasn't always grown big enough. The European races that have been shown consistently on GCN and Flow has done a lot. You know, the way that you did Svennis was like, it showed this very specific moment and way of these events unfolding, which gave someone a laser focus version of how to do this sport that is just so confusing for a lot of people from the outside. And then, so when you grow the funnel big enough and you've got GCN doing what they're doing and Flow picking it up, you know, hat tip to Chad for buying rights and putting it on Trek 4 years ago now, 3 years ago, because we wouldn't have Flow or GCN being able to do the same thing as easily or have people ready and willing to watch it. But I think that's what we're missing. We're missing a lot of that. You know, you're going to hear about so-and-so by this date because there's a big race coming up. And without those kinds of milestones, we don't really have a season that people can follow.
So we always hear about, well, you know, and this is sort of my comparison, Norba and the USGP, these sort of, you know, mythic times of when looking back, and I think that there's some, you know, making things brighter than they may have been at the time, but looking back at these great times when cyclocross was strong because we had, and this is the thing I always hear, is this national series, and USGP national series. And then coming today, and the answer seems to be, well, if we only had that, everything then would be okay, or we'd be back mm-hmm. to where we needed to be. I disagree with that. I don't think it's just that. I think that is just a component of what there used to be.
Yeah, I would agree with that. We've got a lot of different ways for people to be a bike rider, and they're more and more every day. And cross has its place. And sometimes it's going to be higher than others and it's going to be able to be something to look up to. But right now we just have a change in the guard. You know, gravel is the place that people can see the people that they think that they know doing the thing that they think that they like to do themselves. Like, that's what cross really is. And so I think that we're going to have a really strong nationals every year. It's going to be a few thousand people absolutely just loving the weekend, loving the time together, loving the racing that's happening on course. And it's always going to be like that. To pull out another 3 or 4 weekends is totally possible, but we just haven't quite gotten there yet.
And I think that you bring up nationals, which is actually the place that I wanted to get to, because I think that is it is this thing that we still do really, really well. And I think it's also the thing that we have everybody's attention. You're absolutely right. And that's sort of the conundrum of the sport, that it is this participatory sport. So if you're saying, hey, we're going to have these marquee events 4 or 5 times a year, they're going to happen on Sundays in October and November, not me, but most people are like racing. That's when they're out there racing, you know, that's so they're not going to be like focused in on watching those races. But then you get to nationals and you see what the production can be, and, you know, credit to you and to Brad and to that whole team and USA Cycling specifically for, you know, knowing that that is something important and putting the resources behind it. But that's something that we get this professional looking product that we're go, that is almost at a point frustrating that go, holy cow, this is what this could be. And you look at the numbers and you look at the tens of thousands of people who are, you know, viewing it and are tuning in for these races.
I had some friends, first time nationals riders from San Francisco who went there and, you know, pre nationals, it's, entry fees too expensive. You know, no time to ride on the course, blah, 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 all of the things that are friction points. And then they get there and they're like, oh my God, I've never even considered a cross race looking like this or feeling like this, the way that it rode. Zach and Terry did a killer job with their team and building a course that was like an F1 track at the park just for us. Like we could ride on it and do what we did and race as fast as we wanted. And it was amazing. And that, that really is what that production value truly means. So when the Super Cup started, those were the first races in the US that had a high production value. And then the USGP came up and that also carried that forward. The NACT was kind of a, you know, a different version of that. It wasn't always super well done. It was kind of cobbled together. And so we are missing that consistent, high quality production event that will be there when you get there. And I hope that we can get there sometime soon. I really do.
Yeah. And that's, it, it is interesting because I think those series definitely gave us a look at what it's supposed to look like. And I think that's still, I'm going to show my East Coast bias here, but I think on the East Coast, we still have races with really good production values. I think you can go even go into the Midwest on any more localized version. I think Chicago's doing it, but again, it's nothing centralized. It's not that, that focus. It's not getting to that thing where everybody isn't racing and is focused on a weekend of really top-notch races, which is what we got here, which I want to kind of segue into the actual business of putting on those races. And I had a really great conversation with Brad Soner last week, and we really I started asking him just some behind-the-scenes questions about those broadcasts, starting really with Asheville, which he was very candid on. This was our first year really trying this at a high level. We didn't, we probably didn't bid out as high as we should have for some of these resources. And,
nice
and
way it to put it.
Yeah. And it showed. And you've been there from the start. So from those, I need to pick your brain too about some of the things you remember, just maybe that people don't realize from the nationals that you have covered from the broadcast side.
Well, Asheville was shivering to convulsion in a tent with one monitor where you could see maybe 3.5 cameras.
I mentioned the monitor only because the part that I was able to do with you all when we were doing the between races things, that they had to take that that was the only monitor they had, and you had two different sets and they just carried the one little monitor from set to set.
No one can see us doing air quotes with set, but yeah, no, that was trying to tell the people, the lovely people at Volkswagen who had given their money to an event, trying to tell them that, hey, what if we could do a College Game Day thing? Okay, great. You're going to do a College Game Day thing? Sweet. Do it. And it's like, oh, shit. Well, you've got a guy with like a bunch of shit in the back of a pickup truck. And then we've got another like dude totally stoned in the middle of a scissor lift in the middle of the field who's never been to a bike race before. Is it when you tell him left, he turns to the right, and they tell him right and he turns to the left. Try and direct a show like that. I mean, Chris Lincoln is, he's got a lot of merit badges after all these years of putting together events for us. But yeah, that was really tough. I mean, thank God USA Cycling made winter hats that we could wear those on, you know, in between sets. Well, there was the year, I'm sure Brad talked about the snowblower in Hartford.
Yeah, he gave a really good description just about, because what I didn't realize for that, you know, we all showed up, you know, early in the morning and had heard that the snow plow had run through the cables. What he was describing of them actually like dragging the cables to the point that they were pulling cameras off of the stands, that to that degree, I didn't realize was happening.
Dude, that kind of stuff. I mean, if you're surfing Craigslist for day work and you decide to accept a phone call, yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, the day rate is not what I normally get, but I'll go do it. And then, you know, you pull a few hours on Saturday for big day on Sunday, and then you show up and all the shit that you just did the day before is piled up next to the course, and you're everything's broken. I mean, why would you ever want to suffer for the next 14 hours in the cold, in a blizzard, wherever you drove from? Like, the last place you want to be is sitting on a stand controlling a camera about a race you've never seen before, trying to follow these riders like slipping their way on an icy course. Like, the crew, oh my God, like roadies at least could get beers out of the green room or like backstage, and they might get some of the groupies that would hang out long enough, but they're not getting shit with a bike race production. I mean, those poor people, those are hard earned day rates.
You know, somebody, when we talked about it with Brad, but somebody that I forgot to give a shout out to that I think deserves it in all of that was a former marketing director from USA Cycling, Kelly Feitke, who in the middle of, I think he started probably, I think it was until the men's race that they finally got the camera up that was behind where you, Brad, and Meredith, was Meredith on that?
No, Georgia.
Georgia, right, that's right. It was Georgia, yeah.
She was never cold because she had a baby growing inside of her. So we were shivering our asses off. And she's like, guys, I'm not that cold. What are you talking about?
So you all were up in this sort of this crow's nest above, like, yeah. And it was so cold because there was a lake behind you all, and it was just like blowing across. And then the camera behind you that didn't have an operator, because it was down pretty much all day, and it finally gets up, and Kelly's there, and who, no real experience operating a camera, and he's like, what the hell, I'll do it. And he just jumps in and just starts panning along, like gets all the moves in there, like covering it from the back. And I was like, man, and he was loving it. I mean, this was like the best day of his life that he was able to finally, you know, jump in there and do that. And he deserves credit for that.
Yeah, that was like in between him getting hot chocolates for us, he would man the camera. There were a lot of disappointed parents that morning. And I think that's one of the things that we did really well this year, was to do a full Saturday and then all the supporting races in a really professional way. When we first started that there, went to Reno, we did it again, and we tried to give them their due, but it was never really possible. We never had enough people or the cameras or whatever it was. And then this year, some of our best shows, I went back and looked at as much as I could. Some of the best ones were like the kids. You know, you got a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old out there racing, and there they are, HD, coming across the TV. I hope that their families will look at that for many, many years. If they never do another bike race, that's fine. But they were out there, and they were superstars. It was awesome.
Yeah, no, that was really great this year, just doing the two full days with, and that, you know, this was something Brad and I talked about, with professional crews. I mean, I was talking to one of the camera guys who was back in the orchard, who was like, yeah, you know, next week he was working the Seahawks game. This week he was doing cyclocross nationals, you know, just.
The drone guy. What about the drone guy?
Amazing. Just amazing coverage. So cool. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he was changing batteries and then putting it back up in the air. And
yeah,
he wouldn't miss
sure. Yeah.
That's awesome. I mean, all the amateur, all the Mavic pro guys out there are like, oh yeah, I could have totally done that. Like, really? All day?
I can tell you, I think I've gotten pretty good operating a drone, at races and stuff, but it's a completely different level. I have one coming back from repair right now where they had to replace one of the arms. So,
oops,
I know what goes on.
So I have one more story from Hartford. Little known fact was me pre-riding the course to help Katie Keough. We go up to the off camber, the big icy off camber that everyone saw. We ride across the top, we stop, and we're going to go down this next little spot. And I walked 3 or 4 feet forward and I did a cartoon crash. My feet slipped out from underneath me. I fell on my side and I broke some ribs. It was so fucking painful, because then the entire next day while we're on camera, I was shivering. And as I was shivering, my ribs were hurting. So if anyone listens or watches that, I couldn't take a deep breath. So I'm talking, my shoulders are all forward like this, like I can barely open up at all. And I'm sitting there like trying to take small voices, small breaths. And Brad's like, he's like, dude, are you okay? I'm like, no, I'm not okay. It was so bad.
You want to know what my memory from that is for the races that I sat in with you all? The headset that I got did not have any input for you all in it. So, and you, like, there was a certain times you're looking over me, and you all have to understand that Tim, professional Tim, can be a little intense sometimes.
I'm in the middle of the fight, man.
And you're looking at me once, and I said something, and I think I spoke over Brad. You're like, sort of like just pointing at me to basically shut up. And I'm like pointing. I was like, I'm reading lips. I can't hear a thing. I am reading your all's lips. But it was no compassion at all coming from you. I was like, all right, I'll just figure this out.
Oh God, we're in the trenches, man. Good work. Good save then. Good save. I never heard that. I feel like an asshole.
No, not at all. No. Hey, you made up for it, you know, that year or so later when we got to cuddle together in Japan with no heat.
Also, no heat. Yep.
You
know what? Man, those are some sleepless nights. Nobuyama, I think, is the scene of the Rafa Cycle Club meetup this year, if they host it, which would be pretty cool.
Yeah, that'll be really neat. But yeah, no, it was, I think my comment as we were going to sleep, fully dressed with everything we own, was like, we'll save some time in the morning, not have to get dressed.
Should we actually sleep?
Yeah, right.
Like, assuming we sleep, we won't have to spend any time in the morning.
Yeah, exactly. Those were good times. So any as we sort of like wrap up here on our hour, Tim, nice work with the foundation this year. I think the whole Mud Fund was a huge success. Just having this, you know, I think that the public in the past always wanted to help out and to donate, but to have something focused for cyclocross that you could say, okay, if I go to this page, if I donate this money, I know this is going to the development of these up and coming racers or even established racers that we want to do well on the world scene. That was really cool. Just to be able to have that, to know, those evil people at over at USA Cycling are just going to steal my money and put it into some like thing that doesn't have anything to do with cyclocross, I think is the way that, you know, unfortunately a lot of people are thinking about that. We knew that this was laser focused on cyclocross and developing athletes. It was really neat. And I'm glad that you were one of the people that was able to spearhead that.
Yeah. Literally a dollar in is a dollar to the budget. That's how it works. At Worlds, the Worlds was amazing. As I said in that email, the photo of Steven, Kerry, Curtis riding by as Maddie's up on the podium getting her medal, like, it's a moment that, you know, she'll remember forever. Even if she wins another 5 medals someday, it doesn't matter. Like, that was huge for all of us when she was up there. I think that that was really the time that I realized that we had full buy-in from everyone. We had full buy-in from the best in our sport, all the way down to the kids who were there. I think I went to 12 or 13 worlds, and you know, being that kid who can't speak because you're with your superstar colleagues, like all the way up to being one of the leaders of the team. It's crazy what the difference is like from someone who's, 15 or 16 racing for the first time, all the way up to someone in their 30s racing again. It's the expectations are different. The field is different. This year, the staff, the way that Jesse put together the different staff members from the US and bringing them in to help their, favored riders all the way to anyone who needs a hand, the structure of it, the different coaches for the different groups of riders. Like, that's the kind of stuff that we can do when we have money. If without money, it's every man for themselves, every woman for themselves, every kid for themselves. And there's a difference in resources. So when we actually have a lot to work with, we can do a lot of stuff. And I don't think that it's really a measure by medals at the Worlds. It's like, what did we feel like when we were there? And what was it like when we got home? And we were returning superstars. We were returning like heroes from the weekend. And anyone who watched the coverage saw how brutal it was. And if they could have only felt the wind or the cold or the mud ripping your shoes off your feet, like, they might have seen it even more. But yeah, I mean, there is a difference. When we have support, we can do really cool things.
I think that's a great point too. It was something I was thinking about with it being not only riders, but also staff from the US, because that in itself is building this community that when these, especially these younger riders, go home and next season when they're at a race and they see Myron or Chris or even Bill when he was there or Brenna, working in the pits, they know all these people, even though they're not working for USA Cycling at that point, they're back with their teams. And that's what really brings, I think, that community that much tighter. And it sort of builds out from there, which was a really cool added element to it this year, because I know in the past been European mechanics and that kind of thing. So sort of having that homegrown approach from roots on up was pretty cool.
My first Worlds was in Paris, 1996, and it was a long time ago. We had one mechanic. We had like seven or eight riders. We each had two bikes. The majority of us had borrowed bikes, and they were total pieces of shit. And the one thing I remember from our mechanic, Ian said, Tim, and so this is Ian, who worked at BMC for a long time, and who now I think is at CCC. He's like, Tim, I can tell the difference between a bike that was just washed in a bike that was just washed for the first time. And I was like, I'm like, what?
Amazing.
I'm like, what do you mean? I totally borrowed this bike from someone I didn't really know and was psyched to have this bike to race on. Blew my mind. I was like, I didn't know you could do that.
That is so funny. Outstanding. All right. I think that's a good place to end. Tim, I think that other than getting the chance to talk to you for the podcast, I am also using this as kind of an excuse during these isolated times to just be able to talk with people. So thank you. Thank you for agreeing to do that. I loved it.
Anytime, man. Work from home is it's a foreign word to some people, but it's very familiar to others.
Oh, for sure.
You know who you are. So sorry that it's just a continuation. At least on a snow day, you can kind of go outside and really don't have to work from home. Now it's like the never-ending snow day, yeah. And you can't go outside and play.
Yep, we'll get through it. We'll get through it eventually.
Yeah, for sure. Well, call anytime. I'm here.
All right. Thanks, Tim.
Ringy diggy.